Okay, well it's just about 1 o'clock, so let's make a start. Hello. So I'll just begin by saying that I'm aware that some people will want to leave before the end of the talk because they want to go to another event. And it may be that some people will be arriving late because they'll have been to another event again downstairs. So that's fine. Yeah? If you need to leave, just leave. That's perfectly all right. Okay, well, my name is Satchadaya. I'm a member of this order, the Triratna Buddhist Order. And what I've been asked to do today is to talk about karma. To talk about karma in particular in the way that it applies to the mind. Before I say anything more about that, I just want to begin, as I always do if I give a talk, by acknowledging that everything I have to say has been passed to me by a succession of people from my immediate preceptor here, whose name is Maitreya Bandhu, back over 2,500 years to the Buddha. So I don't have anything original to say. I'll just leave it there. Express my gratitude to all those people involved in passing on to me what's been, life-changing, a life-changing practice. I think I also might say that, of course, we get teachers from various areas in our life, don't we? My kids have taught me the value of putting other people in front of me. So I express my gratitude to them. They're both in the room. And also I want to say something about my grandson, who asks the most brilliant questions. In fact, he does nothing but ask questions. There he is, there. His questions come down to one single question, which is, what is it, Granddad? This is what he wants to know. What is it? And, it's kind of, I think, disappointing for him to know that there's 61 years between us, and I don't know the answer to that either, but I have the same question. So in a sense, Buddhism starts from that question. Yeah? We could say, what is it exactly? So we find ourselves in this situation. We don't quite know why or where we've come from. We have what I'll describe as consciousness arrives in us. And I suppose what we then do is we spend a lifetime, or those of us that are interested in this, in trying to understand exactly what that means. So here I am, I'm alive, I seem to be in a situation. What am I going to do with that? What am I going to sort of make, as it were, of that reality? And in a way, that was the question that the Buddha had all those years ago. And what we're told was that he set out to answer that question and was, in a sense, successful in coming to some sort of answer to it. What exactly is my experience of being here now alive? Yeah. And the main thing that he had to say, do come in. Okay. Just don't worry, just walk through the, grab a mat, whatever you need. Do come in. And the main thing that he came up with was that whatever it is that's going on, it has to do with the mind. So it is in the mind that we need to explore our experience if we're going to make any sense of the fact that we seem to be here now alive. So Buddhism then concerns itself with the mind. Buddhism in fact would say that everything that we experience is the mind. The Dhammapada, which is probably the oldest collection of Buddhist teachings brought together in one book, if you like, one writing. The first line of that, so the first line of the oldest written record of the Buddhist teaching, is that experience is led by mind, produced by mind, and recognized by mind. So let's explore that a little bit. So if I'm going to talk about karma of the mind, we have to say something about what we think the mind is. In this context, I'm talking about our psychophysical experience. So I mean thought, emotion, feeling tone, physical sensation. This is our perception of our internal and external world. This is what I'm meaning when I'm talking about the mind. I once met a Buddhist nun whose name was Tenzin Palmo. I don't know, you may or may not have heard of her. Actually, she's from Bethnal Green. She used to live above a fish shop in the Bethnal Green Road. She's now in India, and in the intervening period she spent 12 years living on her own in a cave. She would say that... she came into this world as a sort of continuation of a life that she had before. I don't know about that. I may say something about that a bit later if we've time. But anyway, what she was saying to me when I was talking to her about this subject, well, what exactly is the mind, was that she related it to the experience of going to the cinema and seeing a film. And that's really struck me as being maybe a useful way to think about it. Do come in. Just come in. So we go to a cinema and we sit down, and there we are, as it were, as an observer of a series of images which is projected onto a screen. So there is sound, there is activity, there's action, and that evokes in us some sort of a response. Often some sort of an emotional response. And that is being projected and played out against a screen which sits at the back. So if we can maybe start to think about our minds in this respect, it helps us to sort of begin to get into the Buddhist idea of what we mean when we say mind. So there's these things going on, people, places, sounds, activities and so forth, and it all seems so real at the time. So we sit there and we kind of get caught up in it, and it's as though we're in the middle of it and we become part of it. But in actual fact, it's just something which is being projected against the screen. So we could think of our own minds, of our own consciousness, as being that screen upon which all the things and activities that we call our life is being projected. So this takes us to a crucial teaching of the Buddha's, which is that there is no fixed, unchanging self. Yeah? All there is the ever-changing flow of that which we experience. In this example, if you think of this metaphor, that sort of projected it onto a screen, as it were, in front of us. So there's no soul. There's nothing which sits separate from those experiences which come into us through our senses. In Buddhism, we talk about six senses. There's the usual five, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, etc. And there's also, the easiest way to talk about it is thought. So what Buddhism says is that's not our thought. Thought just arrives. Right? A thought just comes into our minds. We didn't decide to have the thought, there it is. And Buddhism talks about that as being another sense. Okay, so we've got this stuff going on, That's all we know. There's some sort of observer of that stuff. That seems to be true. So if I were to say to you, what are you thinking? Well, then you might have to stop for a minute, but you could probably give me some indication. You could probably tell me what it is that you're thinking. If you can tell me what it is that you're thinking, there's some part of you that knows that. Right? So in this metaphor, that's the person who's sitting in the seat, watching the action going on. And it's being played out against what? Well, I'll call it a screen. What is it, George? What is it? We don't know. We don't know what that is. We can call it consciousness, but that's really just a kind of a convenient way of speaking about something which is deeply mysterious. Okay, so I've confused us all greatly. I think this is an indication that this is a very difficult thing to talk about. Because really and truly, it's beyond words. How can we talk about what we are? You know, from what perspective can we sort of form that view? So it's quite tricky, and that's why sometimes, and I'm going to talk about that this a bit later. Well, we certainly need metaphors. We even need images. All right. Well, so hopefully I've given you some kind of a flavour. Of what I mean when I say the word mind. So what is the characteristic of mind? What are the characteristics of this experience that we have? Well, Buddhism would say change. Everything is changing all of the time. All there is change. All there is a continuous flow of thought, feeling, experience. Yeah? Nothing is fixed, nothing is permanent. And if I were to say to you that in the moment the cells were formed which brought you into being, they were dying simultaneously. There was no time at which we could say, okay, now here I am, I'm born, I'm alive, now we'll make a start. Yeah? It's not like that. As I'm talking to you now, I'm aging. We can't see that immediately, but that is true. I'm different than I was when I first started speaking. We all are. So it's not that there's here I am and I am changing. There is only change. And you can see this in any area of life that you choose to pick up on. So now I'm going to look at some of those areas, because we're moving now into the area of this notion of karma. Because what Buddhism is saying is that this change process is not completely random. It has a law which underpins it, and that law, you could broadly say, is the law of cause and effect, is the law of karma. So traditionally, in traditional Buddhism, karma is described in five different ways. For those that are interested in these things, these are called niyamas. Niyamas, that's the Pali word for it, Pali being the oldest language that Buddhist teaching was written in. And niyama roughly means natural law. So one example of karma is what I would call physical, utu niyama. So things which are not alive, if you like, things which are inanimate, the law of karma applies. So, in dependence upon wind and rain, mountains change shape. So, in dependence upon, precipitation, water falls from the sky. George was asking me, where does the sea come from? So that was my clever answer. It comes from the rain and the clouds. And he said, where do the clouds come from? Don't ask me any more questions. So this is an example of where the law of karma applies to, let's say, inanimate objects. So it applies in geology, it applies in physics, it applies in chemistry, those kinds of areas. Things don't just happen, they happen as a result of things which have gone before. So the important thing to draw out of this example is that nobody's making it happen. Yeah? And this is a real difficulty, I think, that many of us, particularly those of us from Western culture, find it quite hard to get hold of. Because even though we may not believe in God or have any religious belief, we sort of think that someone's in charge. Yeah? That somehow or other there's some sort of reward and punishment system going on. That we will kind of benefit somehow or other. As long as we can not get caught, we can sort of get away from with things. Because there's this God-like figure represented often, you know, as a judge or as a parent or as a teacher or however we want to call it. Buddhism doesn't hold with that. So Buddhism doesn't include any belief in God. Buddha was a man, just like me. What the Buddha achieved in terms of enlightenment, I'll try and say something about what I mean by that later on. You can too. I can too. Yeah? So in Buddhism, our aim, if you like, our movement towards, moving towards a higher state of consciousness, which we can call enlightenment, is within the remit of all of us. Okay. So there's one example then, Uti Nyima, the physical inanimate world and the way that the law of karma impacts upon it. The second one is biological, Bia Nyima. So there is a law of cause and effect. My mother met my father. One doesn't like to think of these things, but something went on of a biological nature, and as a result of that, the cells came together, which eventually made what I now call Satchidaya. There is no real Satchidaya; all there is a constant change of flow. But you know, for convenience sake, let's say that's what happened. So there's this biological process. Those were the conditions that brought Satchidaya into being. So anything that's alive is alive because of a set of conditions which brought that life into being. If any of those conditions had been different, my father's bicycle had got a puncture on the way to their liaison, I wouldn't be here. So the conditions sit behind everything that we can experience. That's the law of karma. Yeah. Psychological, citta, which usually is translated as mind. So we have thought, and there is a process which goes on inside our minds. I almost say inside of our heads, but that's very Western. If you ask a Tibetan, or certainly a Tibetan monk, where the mind is, he points here. So I think that in itself tells you something about the way we function. Anyway, in this context, the law of karma applies to a process which is in our minds. And this is another whole talk, but I'll give you a brief indication of what gets said. So we come into the world with some sort of consciousness, something we can call consciousness. Deep and mysterious, don't know exactly what it is, but there it is. There's our screen, which sits behind the projection in the cinema. And because we have consciousness, and because we have six senses, some sort of contact is made with the outside world, and bearing in mind I'm including our inner thought process as well. So in dependence upon consciousness arises contact. Yeah? We've seen something, we've heard something, something has come in. In dependence upon contact arises feeling. So what's being suggested here is that everything which comes into us through our senses has associated with it a feeling tone. Word for this is Vedana. It's got some sort of a flavour. So this is something which, well, you could check out with your experience. It's something any meditator soon notices. That we look at a certain thing, particularly a certain person, and it evokes in us some sort of a feeling tone, which is either pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between, which if we really pay attention to, is usually biased one way or the other. In dependence upon Vedana, feeling arises craving. So we're in this continuous process, and bearing in mind, talking now about mind, how the mind works, of connecting with something, having a feeling tone, and if it's a pleasant feeling, trying to move ourselves towards it. If it's an unpleasant or uncomfortable feeling tone, trying to move ourselves away from it. Yeah? In dependence upon craving arises grasping or aversion, so we grab it or we push it away. And dependence upon grasping arises what's called becoming. So how becoming means, this is my experience just now in this moment. And there's been a sequence of events which have led up to me having that experience. And that sequence of events I'm describing as karma. So far, hopefully, all very straightforward, all very provable, if you like. You might try it, you know, as you walk around, you just look at things. What's my feeling tone in relation to that? The shape of that light shade there. Neutralish, you know, I don't know. Sometimes it's not very obvious. Quite like those windows. I like the way the light comes in. Yeah. Those are three areas, and the fourth area I'm now going to talk about is called karma niyama, and this is something which you may find more controversial. Karma niyama says there's an ethical element to all of this. Now I don't know how you feel. I really would prefer it if this wasn't the case. Yeah? I find the idea that I have to somehow or other experience the results of my ethical thoughts, words and deeds as being very inconvenient. Yeah? I would much prefer if that wasn't the case. Yeah? So therefore, I mean, I'm personally very reluctant to believe it. But unfortunately, what I've found over the years, particularly since I've been engaged in the practices of Buddhism, where I've been examining my mind, looking at this cause and effect process going on, I'm forced to conclude that there is something in it. Yeah? So I'll just give you a simple experiment, a simple example. What's it like when you're kind? Yeah? If you do something kind for somebody, or something generous, or something which has come from an attitude of open-heartedness, I experience a kind of a bit of a bigger me. I experience a sort of an expansiveness. I benefit from it. I really feel the benefit of my generosity. If on the other hand I'm mean, tight, sharp with somebody even, that feels like something a bit more gnarled, I get more closed down, I start creating all sorts of stories which justifies my behaviour, gives me a bit of a headache, it's a struggle. Okay? There's the law of karma as it relates to ethics. It's really simple, and you can check it with your experience. And this is the great thing about any of the Buddha's teaching, because the Buddha said quite famously, Don't just believe what I'm saying to you. Check it with your experience in the way that a goldsmith would test the value of a piece of gold. Check it between your teeth, yeah? Melt it down. Talk to someone who knows about these things. Is it true in your actual experience? It has nothing to do with belief. Sometimes you can hold a belief lightly and just check it out later. But by and large, Buddhism is very practical. So this is the law of karma as it applies to ethics. And I think often people find this quite difficult to take on, or they come with an assumption that it's more to do with reward and punishment. Yeah? That somehow or other you end up, you know, being kind of punished for bad behaviour. It's an attitude which comes from the idea that there's a God. So it doesn't work in Buddhism. It's just a fact, like the law of gravity. And the final area, which is called Dharma Niyama, I'm going to say very little about. If you're interested in this subject, someone's giving a talk on this a bit later. I think it might be 3:30. And basically what this is saying, that there is something outside of our ordinary, everyday, mundane kind of mind, which we can't really find words for, we can only call transcendental. There's something more than, bigger than me, in that small way of talking about it. We immediately run into trouble because we can't really say much about it. It's outside of time and space. It's not rational. Has nothing to do with anything that I can really talk about. And for that reason, what we do in Buddhism is that we make a representation of it, of the transcendental, and we stick it up on a plinth, and we try and make it look pretty with flowers and candles and so forth. And then we do what we can in our psyche, if you like, metaphorically, to move towards it, because that's what we would really like to be, and it's represented by the qualities that are associated with this figure. Where this figure itself, of course, has nothing to do with any of that. It's a plaster, probably made of plaster, I don't know. It doesn't have any intrinsic value in itself. It's just what we've chosen that it's representing. So what Buddhism is saying is that so there's that somewhere or other, and that also applies to cause and effect. So as I move towards it, hopefully I become more like it. Buddhism is a path. You see, we're trying to get somewhere. Okay. How are we doing? More or less with me. It's like, to try and stand up in the space of half an hour and communicate this, this tradition is not very easy to do. I can only drop in hints. Because ultimately, and I'll take this opportunity to make this point, you have to actually do it, Buddhism. If it's one thing, it's a practice. It's something that you do. And you do that by meditation, you do that by trying to practice ethics, checking what your experience is in response to those practices. And then that kind of keeps you, as it were, going, edges you forward towards this, whatever this may be. Okay. So I've said something about mind. I've said something about karma. Hopefully I've widened out a bit I'm assuming most people's idea of karma is. The thing with one's experience is that one never really knows which of those five karmic elements are the conditions which have brought about the experience that one is having. In some Buddhist traditions, there's a very simplistic attitude taken to this, that everything is on the ethical plane. What I'm saying is that's not my my experience of it, not my understanding of it. So I have something comes into my mind. Maybe I feel low or flat, or you know, a bit depressed or something like that. I'm sure that there's a mixture of all the elements that I've talked about that brings that into play. So what I want to do now is give some more of an example. Is all right about how that actually works. So we start at the top. So I'll get an imaginary flip chart here. Oh no, PowerPoint, isn't it, Adam? Flip charts. People don't have flip charts anymore. I lament the passing of flip charts. Life used to be so much simpler. Yeah. All the time lately, I'm telling people things, and they like about the old days. This is what happens. That's progress. You see, process. Yeah? See, we're changing. But we are changing in one particular direction, aren't we? Somebody gave me a seat on an underground train. I couldn't believe it. I think they were talking about someone else. So this is what we find. It just sort of comes at you. There's a warning thing. Well, I tell you what it means is, I've really got to get on. If I'm going to move towards this ideal and be a healthier, happier, more integrated person, I've really got to get on. It's late. Yeah? It's late for all of us. Life is so short. It's just it flies by. I was that size not very long ago. It really is. Certainly my son who's here, is 30 years old. It just seems like the other day. So we've really got to get on with this stuff. We've got to get on the meditation cushion. If we want to change our lives, we've got to start right now, because it may not be here tomorrow. I'm reminded of that more and more urgently. I must get on with my talk. But the other day, I was telling somebody something, and he said, "You told me that yesterday." And it really shocked me. All day I was thinking, oh my God, I couldn't even remember after he told me that's what I'd done. So it's not just about dying; it's about holding on to one's one's faculties. 10 years from now I won't be able to stand here and give this talk. I can hardly remember what happened yesterday. Now another 10 years of this, I'm going to be good for nothing. So I really got to get on. Okay, I'll get on with my talk. So, perception then. So I've got this thing that I'm calling consciousness. That consciousness makes contact with the outside world. That evokes a feeling tone. Okay. Now what I do with that feeling tone is I turn it into a story and a drama. The Sanskrit word for this is prapancha, there is no real translation for it. That's why so often when you hear these talks, people talk in, use Sanskrit words or Pali words, because you can't. There's nothing really equivalent. But usually, prapancha is translated as rumination. So I have some sort of a thought. It has a feeling tone associated with it, and then immediately I'm into usually something like "poor me," "this only happens to me," "life is so unfair," "it's not my fault, it's her fault." It's usually her, but it can be him. Yeah. I think in the intimate relationship is the best example. If you're here with your partner, you better try and keep a straight face now. If only you would do what you're supposed to do, I would be all right. Yeah? So we turn this... what we're doing here is that we're turning our raw experience into something else. And that something else is influenced by biology, the law of karma as it relates to biology, something to do with sort of who I am, and the things that I've inherited from my mother and father, and from my ancestors. there's some things that are about me that I can't really account for in any other way. My son's walked out the door now. If you'd have seen me walking behind him, you'd say, my God, you're exactly the same walk. Yeah? We sound the same on the telephone. It was very useful when he was a teenager, because his friends used to ring up and it would be some time before they knew it wasn't him. By which time I found out all sorts of things. It's before mobile phones, you see. That's interesting, isn't it? You won't know this, but we used to have phones actually in the house. And they rang, and you used to pick it up, and everyone could hear what you were saying. And also there's an ethical flavour, without question, which has built up with me and all of us, I would suggest, by habit over long periods of time. So, for instance, it might be that you're more likely to think that the world is your enemy, that people are out to get you, you're engaged in a sort of a kind of a war. There's you and then there's the outside world. So your thought process, this rumination, the development of your experience into a story, is more likely to be flavoured with that. If you're fortunate to be of a very naturally very generous nature, especially if you've been practising that, you're more likely to see the same experience in a much more sort of benign way. Yeah? But what I'm suggesting is, what I'm trying to get to is these karmic principles that I've already spoken about, I'm trying to give you an idea about how they actually apply to your mind, how we actually experience them. So there's contact, a feeling tone, because of our biology, because of our ethics, it builds itself into some kind of a story. Yeah. That's all stuff that the mind has generated and produced itself. So it's not necessarily true, because once you get into this idea of true and not true, stuff gets very murky. Or real, or not real. You can pretty soon break it down. Whatever you decide is true and real can pretty soon get kind of challenged and broken up. So, the famous Buddhist story about this is called the Simile of the Two Darts. So the Buddha talks about you make contact with the outside world. It's something difficult, something unpleasant. Maybe somebody said something to you which is hurtful, or you're in a situation which is objectively, outside of any view, difficult. Yeah? And that is the first dart. There it is. You've got it. It's too late to try and do anything about it. It's already there. Yeah? What the Buddha was saying was that what we do is we then throw a second dart at ourselves. Yeah? By developing the story, getting involved in prapancha, making it into something more than that initial difficult thing which came to us through our perception. And the thing is, there's no need to do that. It seems very sort of straightforward, but we don't have to do that. We're doing it to ourselves. Yeah? And this is the world that we live in, actually. The most of the time. So we live in this world that we have created, our mind has created for us. How do we stop it? Well, it's tricky. It's not easy. And I don't want to put out the idea that this is all very simple. The first thing we have to do is we have to develop some kind of awareness of what is actually going on. Yeah? And that's not easy, because it's happening at such a speed and with such regularity, and it has such a feeling of familiarity around it, that we can't see, as it were, the wood for the trees. So we have to develop what I'm calling this quality of awareness. So we have to develop awareness, and the way that we do that is that we adopt techniques that come from the tradition of mindfulness to our experience. It's a learned skill. It doesn't happen by accident. And the easiest and most straightforward way to have this experience is to learn a meditation practice. So a meditation practice is primarily about developing awareness of our experience. So, and then what we have to do, once we've got some notion of what we're actually experiencing, is to try and stay with that initial experience, that first thought. Okay? So, it's only a feeling. It's all right. You know? We can have a feeling. This is particularly relevant when we're downstairs, when we look at areas when we start to get, we start to suffer in our minds, depression, anxiety, and this for me in particular, addiction. What I'm doing when I'm taking intoxicants is I'm trying to change my feeling. I'm trying to get away from my feeling. And the solution to that problem is to just turn and face and allow oneself to experience one's feeling tone. That's all it is. I don't have to turn it into a big drama, I don't have to turn it into a story, I don't have to respond to other people out of negativity. Until I take their stuff, it's not mine, it's theirs, I can just try to practice responding out of kindness, out of consideration. And in that way, because of the law of karma as it relates to ethics, I experience my life more fully, more wholly. My life becomes pervaded with that attitude of love and kindness as opposed to hatred and irritation and anger. So much of Buddhist practice, certainly at its starting point, is about coming back to our initial experience, allowing ourselves to simply experience it without trying to move ourselves away from it. You don't have to go to a rehab centre to see this working, you just have to sit on an underground train. People do not want, for whatever reason, to be left with their own experience. People cannot bear to simply sit quiet. Everybody has got a screen, haven't they? They've plugged in, things plugged in their ears, something, they're sorting out all that contact and sort of drowning it in something other than allowing themselves to actually have the experience. And it seems like a nightmare world to me. Because, of course, you can't ever do it, it's never successful. Everything's changing all the time. So you're constantly grasping at some sort of happiness, contentment, positive mental state slips through your fingers. You can't find it. So you have to keep going, and you just drive ourselves crazy. Whereas if only we could learn the skill of allowing ourselves to experience whatever it is that comes by way of a feeling tone and just leave it there. Well, I was going to say something about death. Should I do that? Cheer us up? All right, well, I'll just spend a couple of minutes. To be honest, I'm not much interested in the subject. That's why I struggle with it. But I feel I should say something, because I think most people's knowledge or understanding of karma relates to this idea of rebirth. Most people would say, if you ask them, what do you know about Buddhism, they'd say that, rebirth, and do with rebirth. I don't really know what to say. I'll start here. Nobody knows what happens when you die. Nobody knows what happens when you die. Some people have a belief which is so strong that it feels to them like a fact. So they just talk about it as though it were a fact, as though it was sort of intrinsically true. It can never be. It can never be. I mean, there's all sorts of interesting evidence, isn't there? People talk about near-death experiences, past life memories. There's all sorts of anecdotal evidence about people on the ceiling of operating theatres watching themselves having a heart attack and all this sort of thing. It's all very interesting. What is it? No idea. Might be something to do with life after death, might not. Don't know. Don't know. So whatever we say about it, it's a belief. Let's make that absolutely kind of clear from the beginning. Certainly the Buddha talked about rebirth as though it were quite a straightforward thing. But one has to bear in mind that he was living in an age and in a time when it was just accepted as unquestionably. Reincarnation in particular, which is a different thing, I'll say something about that, was everybody thought that that's what it was. But there are Buddhist stories. There's one in particular that I like, where the Buddha says, if there is another life after death, it's really worth practicing these Buddhist practices that I've given some hint for, because you know that will affect the next life. If there isn't, it's really worth practicing these Buddhist practices, because what we do in this moment, we experience in the next moment. Law of karma, there it is. So, you know, the Buddha accepts that it's a belief, it's a possibility. All right, I'll finish with this. So, there's four options, aren't there? There's this life only. We get born, we live this life, and then we die, possibly. We're born, we live this life, and then we go on to some other life, like heaven. Seems a bit unlikely, but I suppose it might be true. We have some sort of life before, but it ends at the end of this life, or we have a life before and then we have a life afterwards. There we are, four options, take your pick. I think with Buddhism, the fact that there is a law of cause and effect, and that there is a flow, and that things that happen depend on things that happened before, it's reasonable to say that there is some sort of connection between one life and another. And certainly the older I get, the more intuitively there seems to be something in that. Because I don't really know. I don't really bother giving it much time. And now I definitely will finish here. So Buddhism doesn't hold with the idea of reincarnation in the same way as I understand it that the Hindu religion does. So because bear in mind that Buddhism doesn't accept the fact that there's a fixed, unchanging self. Yeah? So there's no soul. So there's nothing in a sense to get reborn. It's not like I take off the Satchidaya jacket and then put on the, you know, Fred Smith jacket next time round, but there remains something that's unchanged in the middle of that. That can't be the Buddhist view, because the Buddhist view says there is no such thing, all there is changing flow. So the way it's normally spoken about is rebirth, meaning that when consciousness first springs, it springs as a result of some consciousness which has gone before. Yeah? This is the notion. Buddhists, especially from the Himalayan area, think that consciousness is fundamentally ethical. So the ethical flow, the karma niyama that I spoke about, transmits itself, as it were, as an undying kind of source of energy. I don't know. Who knows? I think the Tibetan view, and don't quote me because I really don't know much about this stuff, is that there is a flow of consciousness which has existed since beginning this time and will always exist. And what happens is it takes a certain form depending on its ethical flavour for the period, in my case, of my life. And then when I die, that form, as it were, depending on the flavour of the ethics that I've kind of infused it with, goes back into this consciousness to come into form again at some other point. So I've got nothing much more to tell you about that. I just thought I'd try and give you some sort of notion of the traditional Buddhist view. But bear in mind what I say, I don't know what's true. Nobody does. Okay, good. Well, I think that's about it. You'll be relieved to hear. We've got probably 7 or 8 minutes. If we want to make use of it, we don't have to. I'm sure other people got all sorts of things they'd rather be doing. But if you do have any questions or comments or anything that you want to say, I'm more than happy to hear them.
Can I just ask you, just it's not success, but you say very knowledgeable about, but Tibetans, they have a concept of the Lama, don't they? The Dalai Lama.
Yes.
Is he not supposed to be like a reincarnation of a previous Lama in there?
Yeah, but he's the reincarnation of a Bodhisattva figure called Avalokiteshvara.
Okay.
But Avalokiteshvara is only a changing flow.
Okay.
You see what I mean? There is no actual fixed Avalokiteshvara.
Okay.
I mean, I think what they say about these lamas is that their awareness has got to such a refined pitch that they can actually direct their consciousness after they die. So they can make a decision about what sort of body, if you want, they're going to pop it in. Sometimes it's more than one body and things like that. I don't know. I mean, I've spent time in, you know, in Nepal, and there seems to some of them you've got to think, no, that can't be right. But an iPhone and a Ganja t-shirt, you know what I mean? So I don't know. Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, I've also met some incredibly impressive people, and you just think, well, where does that come from? You know, how do you explain Tenzin Palmer? What made her in 1940 something or other come from Bethnal Green Road and think, I'm going to go and live in a cave for 12 years? You know, where's Mozart come from?
She was 16 when she did that.
16 years old. How do you explain it? You know, she had this clear and solid notion that she had a mission. She had to go and find her teacher. Where'd that come from?
Do you have to explain it? I'm just curious.
I can't explain that. I just can't. I don't know what the explanation for that is. How do you explain Mozart?
But do we need to be able to explain Mozart?
Well, it depends on what our question is. See, I think most people are kind of fiercely interested to know what happens after we die, aren't they? Isn't that the basis of kind of most religion, really? So, this child comes into being and he seems to be able to write symphonies, and he's four or something. Don't know. So, something is interesting about it, I think. I suppose that, you know, as long as you're prepared to accept that there's some questions that don't have an answer, it's the question which is interesting. Anybody else? Are we done?
Can you just say something about what, in your experience, would be the best way to integrate positive karma in your daily life, as opposed to, okay, so being ethical when you can, but how, it's not as easy as that, is it? Can you give some advice on how you can do that?
I certainly can do that. So it's... So number one, develop awareness so that you can at least see what's going on and hopefully start to catch unethical things a bit quicker, a bit sort of earlier on in the process. But you've got to bear in mind that it's all stemming from some sort of intention or motivation. And what Buddhism says is that we start off by our motivation being dominated by hatred, greed and delusion. Which all stems from the idea there's a fixed self, there's a me. So I want this, I want that, I don't want this. So what's suggested is that we develop the opposite qualities of loving kindness, of compassion, so that we more habitually act from that motivation. And so here at the centre, for instance, we teach two meditation practices, mindfulness of breathing, which helps us with the awareness, and the metta bhavana, development of loving kindness, which helps to change our basic kind of motivation. So the idea is that as we go on, unconsciously, without having to think about it, we start acting more spontaneously ethical, and then start to get the benefits of that for ourselves and others. Should we leave it there? Thanks very much for coming and paying attention.
Thank you.